from News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, Bill Lockyer has been a fixture in state politics for more than 40 years. During that time, he has held virtually every major elected office in state government, including leader of the California Senate, state attorney general, and state treasurer. As part of our ongoing series interviewing California's key political leaders, we'll discuss how state government and politics have changed over the 46-year political career of Bill Lockyer, one of the state's longest-serving and most successful politicians. We'll also hear from Don Jackson, political advisor to the former Senate Minority Leader Ken Matty, Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor for the Visalia Times-Delta, and Nate Monroe, political science professor from UC Merced. California Retrospective, conversation with former leader of the California Senate, state attorney general, and state treasurer Bill Lockyer.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from Paramount Agricultural Companies, growing healthy food for you and your family.
From the California Channel at the state capitol, Valley PBS, and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with executive director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Our guest, Bill Lockyer, has held positions as leader of the California Senate, the state's attorney general, and is currently completing his second term as the state's treasurer. He's been described as one of the state's most colorful and shrewdest politicians. L.A. columnist George Skelton has said, quote, he might have been governor if he were more ambitious and photogenic and sometimes less blunt. We're hoping he'll share some of that legendary bluntness with us today. Welcome to the Maddie Report.
Thank you.
Well, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about your background. Why and how did you get into politics?
Well, I was from a non-political family. In sixth grade, I volunteered to do the report on the presidential campaign for Adlai Stevenson, who lost to Eisenhower subsequently. And it got me interested in politics. I started to volunteer. I went to Young Democrats. I worked for the legislature while I was still in college in my district, and it just grew. And so it's what I've done.
A passion from an early age.
Yep.
You know, you've worked almost 40 years in state government. Yep. You've dealt with a lot of governors and a lot of legislators. Mm-hmm. In your experience, who were the most effective and why were they effective?
Well, they're all different. There were six governors during my tenure. I was there at the end of Reagan and then everyone subsequent. Actually, a half a dozen legislative leaders over those years as well. Mm-hmm. So they all had a particular skill set, and you know, Pete Wilson was, I think, more aggressively partisan than, let's say, a Republican like George Dukmejian or Arnold Schwarzenegger. In the legislature, Willie, of course, always is mentioned as the master.
And Willie Brown, for those people who don't know.
Yeah, right.
Deservedly.
But of course, people like, the Senate is different in the way it's led and managed. And so people like David Roberti and Ken Matty, Bill Craven, there were other leaders there that generally weren't the leader of the majority party, but they were effective.
Why were they effective? Were they effective? Was it personal relationships? How they approached their job?
Well, a lot of it is just style and personality, and especially if you're in the minority party, but even in the others, being diplomatic and careful with people makes a difference, and getting to know them and what their issues are, and what their districts are like. So, depending on how much of a student you were of the place and the issues and the people, it make a difference.
They said that Ken Matty was he was very diplomatic.
Yes.
In his approach, and was successful as a result.
Yes, and again, people pick topics that they want to work on, and so Ken, I think first, second, and third on the list was horse racing, and so you could kind of make a deal with him if you were the majority leader, because there wasn't a long list that you had to worry about. And I remember one day, to tell a story, so Ken is the leader. He gives me a little piece of paper saying, here's what we hope for. Bob Beverly would be Republican senator, vice chairman of a committee. Mm-hmm. So 4 months later, I give Ken the little list back, the piece of paper. And I said, okay, you got everything on this piece of paper. Here are the eight things you got that you didn't ask for. So you better go take credit with your colleagues.
Well, you know, that kind of talks to the hyper-partisan nature, you know, in today's environment. It seems like working out a compromise is almost, you know, a dirty word. I mean, you saw what happened recently to Eric Cantor. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of
is
this
is a good
reflects,
thing or a bad thing for.
Well, it's bad, but a lot of it reflects where voters are. And these legislators that we view as polar often are just reflective of the districts they come from. And, you know, that's the way housing patterns fall and people re-tribalize. And
you're
so
saying that people are segregating themselves politically.
Yes. Yeah. And so that's part of it. And some of it is the turnover with term limits. There's not mediative skills like there used to be and so on.
We're talking with one of the deans of state politics, Bill Lockyer, who spent a 25-year career in the legislature prior to being elected the state's attorney general and now the state's treasurer. You know, in your extraordinary 25-year career in the legislature, it culminated in 1994 when you were named head of the Senate pro tem. What is your proudest legislative achievement over that time?
It's really hard to pick one when you're involved for that long and touch every policy area. But I would have to say, in terms of a physical thing, the San Francisco Bay Trail. And so it's several hundred miles of trails that aren't completed yet, but they're about two-thirds done, that circles the San Francisco Bay Area, and
we were talking
it's a really nice
before this segment. I've done a similar thing in our community, and the people really enjoy
it. Yeah, it keeps getting worked on, and it's nice to see the progress.
It's like a house; it's a never-ending project.
And then there, you know, I mean, I did things like consumer laws, like the auto lemon law, or my favorite is the four-hour delivery requirement that when you have a TV or a phone, that they got to give you a four-hour window. We're the only state in the country that requires that, and actually, I think that's a good business regulation. And
I think a lot of our viewers can relate to that,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
But let me ask you this. In retrospect, is there any law that you passed that you wish you hadn't?
Oh, sure. And there probably are a number of them, but the one that always stands out, I wasn't involved in the architecture, but I was in the Senate when energy deregulation passed. And it was a flawed and very hurtful enactment to California business and consumers. And it was predicated on this theory of deregulation and competition would be good, and it turned out it didn't work.
There were some backroom deals going on with Enron and others that kind of changed some things.
Yeah, they required the investor-owned utilities to sell off assets that were then purchased by people that ran them like a monopoly, and so it didn't work. And that part of it was federally regulated, couldn't be controlled by the state, so it was a mistake.
In retrospect, is there anything you could have done to kind of anticipate that problem?
No, I was pro tem at the time, so I was working on budget. That was going on at the same time. It was a scrap. And what I did is, on the conference committee that talked about it, appointed a Democrat, Byron Scher was a law professor from Palo Alto, consumer, solar interested, and the right values, and always said, if he's okay, if he says this is good product, I'm convinced. And he said, it's terrific, and he was wrong.
And professors,
that's what you do when you delegate power like that and right. Hope for the right outcome.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think the state passes too many laws? Should there be a limit on the number of bills that the legislature can consider?
Well, I wouldn't put a limit on the number in a sort of formalistic way. It would be good if the culture just insisted on, we'd like fewer, we'd like more thoughtful work to be done, we don't want this volume that we're seeing. Yes, we pass too many laws. A lot of it is just cleaning up what they didn't do adequately the first time. Some of that is because the first time, maybe 20 people are thinking about it, and then it goes out in the world and 200,000 or more are thinking about it, and so you learn something you hadn't considered. But I wouldn't do a formal constraint, but informal ones would be good.
What about sunset provisions in laws that, you know, after a certain period of time, you got to reconsider whether they're still working or necessary?
Well, sometimes it's good. There are certain, like, tax breaks. You want it to be long enough to incent the behavior that you think you're encouraging, but not frozen into statute. But there would be other things. Let's take a federal example. Obamacare. it wouldn't make any sense to sunset that. If it's established, you may need to fix it. You may need to tinker
with it. There are some people that may disagree with you on that.
But I wouldn't sunset. So the answer is yes sometimes, no other times.
What about legislative oversight? You know, they pass a law, then they want to make sure it's working. Do you think it's gotten better or worse over time?
It's inadequate, and it always has been and still is.
Period.
Yeah.
Is there any way to make it better? I mean, we've got term limits now. They're in for a longer period of time. Do you think that's going to help?
You know, it wasn't being done well before term limits, and I think partly it's partly the nature of the legislature. They're not executive branch people, by and large, and so they don't have that orientation and interest. Mm-hmm. It's not flashy.
Right.
It doesn't feed your next campaign to, you know, and so what they will do, and I think it's mostly destructive, is say, well, let's fire the director. There's a problem. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't fix systemic problems that
but
need to
politically
be addressed.
It works.
Yeah.
What about, you know, recently we're reading about these ethical violations that are occurring in the Senate. Is this just the personal failings of a few people, or is there something inherently wrong with the legislature or the legislative process?
Well, it's personal failings, and it's the magnitude and necessity of raising lots of campaign money. And these are mostly circumstances where people are financing campaigns that make them do unethical things. And the ones that aren't breaking the law, in my view, are right on the edge of that because of the need to finance campaigns.
So public financing is a big issue. Should there be public financing of campaigns? Should there be more transparency and disclosure?
Well, transparency and disclosure, there's a lot now. You could expedite it so there would be more quick exposures.
There's probably last-minute donations that come in.
Well, the problem isn't the contributions to the candidate. We get those recorded, and there's a limit on how much they contribute. It's all the underground spending, the independent expenditures. Mm-hmm. You don't know who gave them the money. You don't know how they spent it until maybe, if ever, long after the campaign is over. That's a problem.
We're talking with current state treasurer and former state attorney general Bill Lockyer. So after 25 years in the legislature, you're elected state attorney general in 1998. What were your greatest challenges?
Well, transferring to an executive agency role is different than being in the legislature. It's a different culture, a different skill set, and often legislators aren't good at it. I was lucky to have the right sort of success at it. But so in attorney general, there are 1,200 lawyers, the largest law firm in the state of California, to manage. That's challenging. And they do every kind of law you can imagine. And so partly I was breathing into it more environmental and consumer and perspectives that had been ignored by my predecessor. Then there were a lot of infrastructure needs, like DNA labs that needed to get backlog addressed. And when you do that, you go from catching one criminal a year to catching 20 a day. It's good to do, but you got to work at it. So it's a different kind of hands-on experience.
And you surround yourself with good people, as you were mentioning earlier. So you're termed out as the Attorney General. You've had a lot of experience with term limits. In 2006, you're elected state treasurer, your current position, which ends this year. Mm-hmm. What are you most proud of as treasurer, and anything you'd want to change?
Well, there aren't a lot of things to change. My sort of disappointment there was I worked to try to get the legislature to authorize green building bonds, that is, to do energy efficiency in public buildings. The amount you save is enormous, both money and energy. And I could just never get that going, and that was a big frustration. Probably my biggest contribution is to making sure the professional staff is respected. They're allowed to pick among lots of competition for the deals that we make on bond issues with Wall Street. In the past, there was often a preferred Wall Street house. We don't do that. We make the best deal. We make them compete. And that's a good culture.
And there's competition to it. Well, you know, the Attorney General and the State Treasurer are elected positions. Mm-hmm. Should they be? Or should they be part of the governor's cabinet, like it's part of the president's cabinet mm-hmm. at the national level?
Yeah. It would be okay. There are states that have them appointed. I have seen circumstances. Let's say we go back to the picking the Wall Street financier. If you're the governor, it's 0.1% of what you care about. And it might be a greater likelihood to make it a political decision. Well, these guys were helping in my campaign, therefore they're going to get the business. And it's more likely to get obscured, lost, and bad political decisions being made in that environment.
But couldn't that also happen if you're running for state treasurer?
They can't contribute. They're prohibited to contribute to the treasurer, but they can contribute to the governor.
Okay, yeah.
So I don't think I can see where there's mischief one way and neutrality the other.
Yeah, money. It always goes back to money.
Yeah.
Well, you know, California's got this plural executive branch where there's a dispersion of power across different offices. So we've got the governor making the state budget. You've got the state controller making sure the budget's spent properly mm-hmm. and administers public employee pension funds.
Right.
Then you've got your position, the state treasurer, who sells California bonds and invests and manages the cash. And, of course, then there's legislatures involved mm-hmm. in the
right.
process. So who does what? It's kind of confusing, I think, to the typical member of the public. Does this plural executive approach obscure accountability?
No. And the reason is, first of all, most of the general public that you mentioned don't know who these people are or care much about what they do, so they're not holding anybody accountable other than—
Those watching this show probably do that.
They do. and the governor— that, you know, they'll hold Gray Davis responsible for the energy bill that was written before he ever got elected. So there will be some accountability in some respects. But it's more there are 120 voices in the legislature that I think causes the confusion. It's supposed to. They're supposed to be all the competing geographies and philosophies and interests there. And that confuses people. But what say the controller and treasurer do are so essentially ministerial that it's not a policy matter that voters should worry about. They're not watching which Wall Street firm did I do the last bond deal with. I mean, they probably don't know that we do that. But, you know, so it's not an accountability issue. Now, there may be an efficiency. There may be the political issue that I raised with you if mm-hmm. you consolidate before.
Right.
It may be fewer elections for people to worry about, but it's not an accountability matter.
We're talking with former leader of the state Senate, former attorney general, and current state treasurer Bill Lockyer, who's about to be termed out of that office as well. So you've had a lot of experience with term limits. Do you think term limits are good or bad in terms of improving the performance of state government?
I understand the voters' cynicism about politics, and that feeds the limits sometimes. Mm-hmm. The bad side, I voted no, is there are some members that acquire an expertise in an area. The turnover has been so rapid that there really isn't that collection of policy gravitas that there used to be. Secondly, it amplifies campaign fundraising as you turn over seats. Third, it's more ideological. People come to the legislature full of I'm correctness. It takes a while to realize there's a mediative need. You need to figure out how to make it work. It's right. the collection of all the people that want to see government respond to their concerns. If you do it right, they win sometimes. They don't get that feeling in the polarized environment under the term limit regime.
Yeah. You know, you've seen also a move toward propositions in California. Mm-hmm. I mean, we seem to have a tremendous number of propositions. Mm-hmm. This move toward direct democracy, what impact does it have on the legislative process?
Not very much. Once in a while, someone said, well, if you don't pass something, we're going to go initiate. And typically, people say, well, okay, you can do that. Mostly, it's a tool of some special interest group now to couldn't get their way in the legislature, so they go to the ballot. And and spend money to try to pass something. It is a safety valve, and it can be good in that respect.
You know, we talked a little bit about money in politics, but there's been a lot of money going into propositions.
Mm-hmm. Huge amounts.
Is that a problem?
Well, it is in the sense that you get these campaigns, they're overly simplistic. The deep pockets finance the message.
But don't you think the voters are sophisticated enough to kind of, it's an advertisement, I can see through that?
Eventually, it affects their votes. So otherwise, they wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. So when you see the campaign spending and how it affects opinion polls, it's having some impact.
Let me ask you about kind of the change in the nature of the press. Mm-hmm. Now, newspapers have had their struggles. More and more people are looking to the internet for their information. Mm-hmm. What are the implications? And what are the implications for the press as a watchdog to make sure government is doing the right thing?
Well, as the resources get thinner in newsrooms, they do less investigative reporting. So there tends to be a little more sensational cheap shots and less really in-depth reporting, and it's the nature of the business. I think we understand.
Yeah, it seems like there's more channels to watch, but less to really see.
Yeah.
And they've got to grab your attention with something sensational.
Yeah. That's
interesting.
I've had TV reporters say to me, "You're too cool." The producer said, "You got to get hot or you're not going to have an audience."
Well, that's not good. It's showmanship as opposed to statesmanship, I suppose. Yeah. So what about getting people involved in the political process? You know, we just recently had a primary, very low record, low voter turnout.
Yeah.
Why aren't Californians voting?
I'm not sure. Part of it is a feeling that, gee, my vote doesn't matter. And that may be a function of size or the feeling that everything is run by big something, not me. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if people feel sort of less able to make a difference, or if it's just inattention, busyness with their lives, less value in citizenship. I'm not sure what caused it.
Well, let me ask you this. We've only got a minute left or so in the segment. Yeah. I wanted to ask this question. You've been in elective office for almost half a century,
yeah.
46 years.
Yeah.
So if you could go back and talk to that person 46 years ago, what would you tell that
person?
Well,
I would probably say, do it the way you did it, but do it with more diplomacy. You know, you don't have to kind of be as muscular as I often was in the legislative role especially. But and before we close, I do want to say, the extraordinary thing about this system is it's the only one on the planet where everyone counts, where every voice matters. It's a wonderful idea, and I got to contribute to that.
Well, I want to thank our state treasurer, Bill Lockyer, for joining us. Up next, how have state and local politics changed over Bill Lockyer's 40-plus years in government? We'll talk to Don Jackson, political advisor to the late Senate Minority Leader Ken Matty, Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times Delta, and Nate Monroe, a political science professor from UC Merced.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. So how have Valley and state politics changed over the last 40-plus years? We've got three viewpoints on that issue. Don Jackson is a political advisor, or was a political advisor, to the late Senate Minority Leader Ken Matty. Paul Hurley is a former editorial page editor of Visalia Times Delta. And Nate Monroe is a political science professor from UC Merced. Welcome, all of you, to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. You know, let's start, Paul, with you. There's been a general feeling in the Valley, fair or not, that we're often overlooked by state leaders who are more focused on the Bay Area and Los Angeles. Do you think Bill Lockyer understood and addressed Valley concerns?
Yes, I do, in the sense that he worked with Valley lawmakers. I'm not sure that Lockyer promoted Valley interests so much, and I'm not sure he was all present here that much either. But in the sense of his building frameworks for lawmakers and other public officials to address issues pertinent to the entire state and not just a small region, I think he was. I think it is fair to say that Bay Area and Southern California lawmakers ignore the Valley, and The latest evidence is the incoming state Senate minority leader, Kevin DeLeon, just the other day saying that he didn't want to see high-speed rail going through the valley because there's nothing but tumbleweeds here.
Okay. Nate, what do you think? Was Bill Lockyer a little more open to issues in the valley than some of our current state leaders?
Well, I guess I'm not sure whether I'd say he was more open to it, but if we look at his record and some of the things that he worked hard on, you know, either by accident or by design, they, I think, addressed some issues that disproportionately affected, you know, citizens in the valley. So, you know, he was a big promoter of civil rights and of, you know, some of the, you know, trying to correct some of the inequities that I think fall disproportionately on some of the minority and lower income populations that are heavily concentrated in the valley. You know, he dealt, you know, he took on sort of the prosecution of energy market manipulation, which, you know, I think in a lot of ways, you know, was an important valley issue, and, you know, promoted infrastructure bonds. So I think that there, you know, while I don't know that he was someone who was open to valley issues in the sense that he was, you know, focused on the valley as a particular region, mm-hmm. a lot of the things he did were important for the valley at the time.
You know, Don, there was a working relationship between Bill Lockyer and Ken Matty when both were leaders in the California Senate. How did they get along?
Well, they got along well. They were both consensus seekers. I'd like to tell you one anecdotal story. Back in 94, they were having an internal disagreement over how staffs would be paid because each senator had a set allocation, and he could divide it any way he wanted among his staff members so that some of the chief of staff might be getting $150,000 a year in one case and $100,000 in another. So they had to find a way to resolve it. One of the things that happened as a result of that is that Bill Lockyer put me on the Senate Cost Control Commission. 20 years later, I'm still on it. And then it was a subcommittee. G. Allen Post and I were the subcommittee. Obviously, Post representing Lockyer and the Democrats, and I was there to represent the Republicans. And, of course, Ken was then the minority leader. Long and short, we had a lot of meetings and a lot of reports from Arthur Anderson, and the basic result was there was no change in the structure. They each retained their freedom to pay what they wanted to pay. But it shows you the kind of relationship they had because obviously Ken wanted representation on the committee and the study, and Lockyer was good enough to give it to him. He didn't have to do that. But it's typical of their working relationship for the years thereafter that Ken was a minority leader.
You know, Professor Monroe, Bill Lockyer has been attorney general and treasurer, state treasurer. And in California, those are elected positions. But should they be appointed positions, appointed by the governor, just like they do at the federal level where the president appoints his cabinet? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think you could argue either side of this issue. My personal view is, no, I don't think they should be. I think that, you know, it would concentrate a lot of power in the governor's office, and it would sort of, I think, reduce some, you know, the splintered accountability for those seats, while a bit hard to follow at times, I think creates, you know, maybe a better division of accountability than if we were to concentrate it all in the president's office, in the governor's office, and have it, you know, fall on one person's shoulders. So this is one of the places where our system works a bit better than the federal.
Don, what do you think in terms of, you know, the argument on the other side is, listen, this will result in more consistent public policy. Should it be part of the executive branch?
It's a great philosophical question, Mark, but it's never going to go anyplace. I chaired the Fresno County Charter Review Committee years ago, and among 37 proposals were 5 to make elective offices appointed, coroners, so forth. And all I can tell you was everything passed with those 5 issues. You're never going to get voters to agree to convert an elected office to an appointed office.
Once they have that, they don't want to go back, I guess. Let me ask Paul you this question. Bill Lockyer is almost the poster child for term limits. He was termed out of the Senate. He was termed out as Attorney General. He's now going to be termed out as State Treasurer. I'm wondering about term limits generally. What do you think the impact has had on the performance of Valley legislators?
Well, I think we've seen that it's had a negative impact of performance of Valley legislators. There's been a couple who have done very well with the time they've had. Connie Conway would be one of them. But in the long run, it has undercut the influence of Valley lawmakers and legislators. It's added to the politics of those offices because lawmakers have to run for office and then they're always looking for their next job right away. I do not think it's been a good thing. I'd like to see how it plays out with the new system we have where you can serve 12 years in the legislature in either house.
Yeah, Don, what about that, this new change in term limits where you can stay 12 years in one house? You think it's going to improve their performance, the legislators' performance?
Yes, but let me go back and answer your first question. I think the term limits has hurt the Valley. If you go back, Hugh Burns, Howard Way, Kent, Bill Jones, we've had a string of leaders, and they're elected. They certainly have to have them the L.A. and the Bay Area support to get elected within their houses. And they were elected on the basis of their ability rather than their ability to raise money and support other races for office. I don't think there's any question. I don't know how long it's going to be before we have another of any of those people, including Connie, replaced from the Valley. I just think it's become very caucus-heavy, very political fundraising. And that doesn't speak well for the Valley. So that's my answer to your first question. And as for the 12 years, I think it helps because they have more experience, particularly if they stay in one house and they have a chance to build relationships and seek consensus. And when you're from the Valley, you don't have the power. So you've got to, on the basis of analytics, seek consensus.
Okay. Professor Marone, I want to ask you about that, kind of the political influence of the Valley in Sacramento. Valley politicians used to be able to use seniority to gain influence, and that's really no longer true. So have term limits, what do you think? Have term limits helped or hurt the Valley in terms of political influence?
Yeah, I think you sort of, you hinted at it right there, and Don and Paul sort of alluded to it as well. But the reality is that when you step into a state legislature and you're from Southern California or the Bay Area, you already have some power rooted in or coalitions that are, forged by legislators from your area with common interests, legislators from urban areas with common interests. When you're from the Valley, you start with a disadvantage in political influence. And when you look back at the Valley legislators who have been able to really get a lot done for the Valley, it was folks who were able to leverage their experience and their longevity into this political, and by virtue of that, some of their ability to forge coalitions into political influence for the Valley. And I think that was hurt, really, really crippled by the initial move to term limits, the way that the law was written. And I think this move to 12 years gives them at least a chance for some of those legislators up in our area, Anthony Canella and Adam Gray and folks who are elected in sort of these early classes are going to be able to have a better chance, I think, at reestablishing some of that influence.
Professor Monroe, I want to also ask you about the importance of developing relationships in terms of making the legislative process more effective. You hear a lot of talk about that. Do you think it's really essential to build those relationships, or is it overblown?
I think it's absolutely essential. In fact, I think, one of the mistakes that people make when they, when they imagine what it's like to be a legislator is to forget that those are people up there, sort of engaging in, very human enterprises, and that it's not sort of a mechanistic thing driven by the sort of rules and very pure. Right. It's like anything else. The relationships you have, the people you're going to pick up the phone to call, to talk to consult, to ask for help with, the ability to do those things are what's going to allow things to ultimately get done. And I think, you probably cannot overemphasize the degree to which those relationships are what makes that process effective. And so I think, the rules that get in the way of that, by their nature, cause the legislative process to break down. Mm-hmm. And I think that's some of what we've seen.
Don, you know, you were alluding to that earlier, and Ken Matty was known as someone who worked at developing good relationships with on both sides of the aisle. So, you know, you saw this kind of up close and personal. What are your thoughts on personal relationships and their effect on the legislative process?
Well, I think there's been a major shift. At first, my reaction was that it was, as Nate said, the single most important factor. But I think what's happened now is that the shift really goes to the leader's ability to raise money and spread it around. And the way that you really have to vote with your caucus, or you can easily be on the outside. That's what happened to Juan Arambula, who's really a consensus guy, too, but it didn't really matter. So I think that while it's essential, it's probably fighting a close second with the control of the caucus and loyalty to leadership.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Paul Conway has kind of been in that situation. She's got, you know, great personality, works well across the aisle with her colleagues, but she also is a pretty good fundraiser. Is she the new model of the effective and successful politician?
Whether it's new or not, it's a perfect model. She does both well. Very good at fundraising and at reaching out even beyond her district for those connections that are important, both for fundraising and building her caucus. And she's been excellent building relationships. She's had excellent relationships with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jerry Brown. I mean, you can't do much better than that.
Well, I want to ask one quick question of all of you. Just because it struck me when we were talking with Bill Lockyer, and that is, you know, politics seems to be about timing. And so, you know, if you look at his career, you know, head of the state Senate, then attorney general, then treasurer, you think, well, this is a guy that's lining himself up to be governor, but it never happened. So, Don, I want to ask you, you know, is politics all about timing?
No. I mean, it's all about the money. Put money first always. Bill Lockyer, though, was a prolific fundraiser. When he ran for treasurer this last time, he raised $12,524,000, according to the National Institute on Money and State Politics. But what no one saw is that the iceberg, the bottom of it was that in the prior 2 years, he'd raised $22 million.
That's incredible, amount of money.
Yeah, and most of that money came from, on a percentage basis, came from lawyers and lobbyists and unions, you know.
But just to give a comparison, that's the kind of money that Governor Brown is raising to run for governor. And these are secondary, frankly, level positions, attorney general and treasurer. So that's a pretty amazing amount of money.
I can't tell you why Bill Lockyer didn't run for governor, because he certainly had the ability to raise the money.
Well, let me
the only thing is that if he had to run against Jerry Brown, they'd be tapping all the same sources, so
right.
Who knows how that would work.
Well, I want to see if there's an academic answer to this. So, Professor Monroe, is there an academic answer to, is politics all about timing?
You know, I think the academic answer is sometimes. I think, you know, we hesitate to deal in certainties, but, you know, I think that there are some candidates for whom timing is sort of, you know, secondary, that they're sort of a bit of a force of nature, and that, you know, they're going to find their way, you know, to the office that they're sort of, you know, ambitious to hold, or perhaps destined to hold, depending on how you think about it. And for some candidates, you know, some politicians make it, you know, dramatically further than ever would have, but for luck, and some others that are very skilled, I think, but just don't have quite the right mix of things, aren't fortunate enough to find the gap. And so I guess I don't, you know, I think that it depends on the candidate. And I think Bill Lockyer, you know, for all of his virtues, somebody that timing was not favorable for in that particular case.
Yeah, a nuanced answer that I'd expect from an academic. Well, up next, a discussion of the increasingly hyper-partisan nature of state and local politics and the voter frustration that is increasingly being expressed in the form of propositions to bypass the legislative process. That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We're taking a look back at state government over the last 30 or 40 years and discussing how those decisions at the state capitol have impacted the San Joaquin Valley with Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor of Visalia Times-Delta, Nate Monroe, a political science professor from UC Merced, and Don Jackson, a political advisor to the late Senate Minority Leader Ken Matty. Well, Professor Monroe, let me start with you. Many people think politics has become more partisan over the last 40 years. First, is that true, and if so, why?
Well, it's certainly true in terms of the elected officials that we've sent to the Capitol. So, you know, if you look at voting records and analyze their voting patterns and how much overlap there is between members of the two parties, what you see is just a consistent move where the Republicans and Democrats become more and more, tightly bunched together and further apart, where there's very little or no overlap. That, you know, the why is a tricky question, but I think, you know, at least potentially the answer is that we saw districts that get drawn that were more and more partisan in terms of, you know, protecting incumbents of one party or the other. And so while I don't think there's been nearly the polarization among the public in terms of their attitudes, we've seen institutions translate those public attitudes into more partisan seats. And so I think, you know, that some of the reforms we've seen, for example, the Independent Redistricting Commission, at least have the potential to, and potentially maybe have already begun to elect a more moderate class of both Republicans and Democrats that are beginning to overlap a bit more.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was listening to a political consultant. He was saying we've got politics now where both parties are in their respective end zones, and so the only way they can hear each other is if they scream at each other, because nobody's at midfield. And probably a good way to kind of capture it. But Don, let me ask you: are hyper-partisan politics the new normal, or is this just a moment in time?
I think in the long range, it could last a long time. My view is it's always been partisan. It's just now it's less civil. And the thing I referred to earlier about money raising, control by the caucus, penalties if you get outside the caucus vote, that it's just become, I would say, a little more hardcore, a little more like House of Cards, and a little less like the old days. But it's always been partisan.
Okay, so I guess in the past they smiled more, but they were doing basically the same thing?
Well, I think in the past, eventually they got down to solving the problems and worked them out, generally in the back room or in meetings with... Anyway, I think they got more done, frankly.
Yeah, I think there's another factor here, and that is the electorate, the public itself. It's less informed. It's not paying as much attention. The people who are, though, are the ones who are hyper-interested in politics.
And they tend to be show.
People. They tend to be people who have strongly held opinions on either side. And hopefully they listen to this show.
You know, Paul, you bring up something that's interesting there. You know, politics has been described as the art of compromise. Yet compromise has now become a reason to vote against someone, to vote them out of office. Why has compromise become so politically unpalatable?
Because for some reason, compromise now means that you don't have principles, that you don't believe in anything. You have to hold firm to your core beliefs. And this is a factor. It's a sense in politics that's developed over the last 20 years. And, you know, frankly, I think the religious right and somewhat the liberal left have both contributed to that.
Professor Monroe, am I getting this wrong? Is politics not the art of compromise?
No, I mean, I think that's right. But I think, you know, part of what's happened, and this is probably more true now at the federal level and outside of California than inside, given the recent reforms. But, you know, what's happened is you get such a strong capture in the primary elections of that sort of hyper-partisan primary electorate. And so, you know, where prior to the last couple of the last election cycle with the, you know, top two system, we had, you know, you had to satisfy those hyper-partisan first, and they have no interest in compromise at all. So before we, you know, even get candidates to the general election where that sort of middle, that moderate compromise-seeking constituency is waiting to reward compromise, you have to get past the sort of very, all those folks, all those voters who are standing in their respective end zones and waiting to approve you to go on to the main game, I suppose. So this is something, again, that could change as a result of the top two system, but it remains to be seen whether, you know, that's going to reward compromise in this way.
You know, Don, do you think we're ever going to see the return of the Valleycrat, those politicians from both parties who are willing to cross the aisle in search of bipartisan solutions?
Well, I hope so, but as I said, I think for a while we are where we are, whether the change in term limits and the top two voting will change this. It's probably, we're all looking to that to see if it will make an effective change in who gets elected and how they govern. I don't know. I think we're in for a slow change. I think we're going to have to be patient.
Okay, well, Paul, what about this frustration? You know, one of those things leads to, you know, this hyper-partisan positioning is gridlock in the mm-hmm. legislative process, and that's led to folks looking to propositions to resolve public policy issues in California. On balance, do you think propositions have been good or bad for the Valley?
Bad. and maybe the debate over them has been worse. I think it's one of the things that's led to partisan partisanship and a lot of controversy and contention on those different issues. Starting to see a little softening of that now, though. Not as quite as many propositions are being proposed this election cycle or the last one. You've just seen two now state budget cycles that have gone fairly smoothly. You know, of course, they changed the rules to get that done, mm-hmm. but there's at least been some easing of that gridlock process. And again, I think if people would pay attention and understand what needs to be done in their best interest, I think it would probably improve even more.
So you think, Professor Monroe, propositions, good or bad for the Valley?
I think bad. And I think, you know, bad not just for the Valley, but for the whole state, but perhaps even worse for the Valley. And, you know, one of the things I was just sort of looking at the initiative process in other states and thinking about how that compares to ours. And so, for example, in Florida, any initiative that asks to allocate or asks for new spending has to, in the same initiative, identify the funding source. Mm-hmm. And that very simple requirement is something that's just so badly missing from the California initiative process, where so often the state is being required to allocate spending for new programs and hamstringing the budget in ways that really hurts regions that desperately need the money, but often spends that money in ways that it doesn't consider the trade-off.
Yeah, that ballot box budgeting has often been an issue. Let me ask this last question of all of our guests here. We've only got about a minute left. Start with you, Paul. Going forward, what do you see the role of the San Joaquin Valley playing in state politics?
I would like to think that the San Joaquin Valley could be a bridge in state politics, both geographically, but
so we're purple
ideologically. Yeah, we could be green or gold too. I don't know, but you know, there's a lot of things about the Valley that are still misunderstood. De Leon's comment the other day, for instance. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this recent budget...
By the way, I've heard a similar comment from Republican legislators, you know, the train to nowhere.
Yeah, well, that's right, the train to nowhere. But there is... this recent budget did address a lot of Valley needs. So I think that might be changing a little bit. So going forward, if local lawmakers can do the same kinds of things that some of our past lawmakers have, like Ken Matty, like Connie Conway, and build relationships, it could be beneficial for us and the state.
We only have a few seconds left. So, Professor Monroe, quickly, where do you see the San Joaquin Valley in state politics going forward?
I think that depends on how the economy of the Valley moves forward. If high-speed rail actually takes off and get some infusion of money, if fracking all of a sudden brings an enormous amount of oil dollars, if the UC in Merced that I'm at creates a more, you know, a bit more of a robust economy, it could change things and have a lot more influence and be a bigger player in state politics.
Okay, Don, you got the last word.
I think the one thing we haven't mentioned, I agree with everything said, but his leadership, what's always brought the Valley into the picture has been that we've had outstanding leaders come out of the Valley to lead in the legislature. I think that's important that we continue to develop that leadership. And, of course, that's a good part of what the Manny Institute is trying to do.
I think we're going to end right there. I want to thank Don Jackson, political advisor to the late Senate Minority Leader Ken Matty, Nate Monroe, a political science professor from UC Merced, and Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor with the Visalia Times-Delta. Thanks, all of you, for joining us. If you want to keep up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, The Matty Daily, by just logging on to our website at mattyinstitute.org.
The Matty Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for The Matty Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.